Welcome back to Never Found, Never Forgotten. I am Melanie, and I am so very sorry for my negligence to this podcast. I really am. These are very strange times that we are living in currently, and I have been having a hard time balancing homeschooling, work, and a podcast, all while feeling completely overwhelmed and anxious about everything that's going on in the world. So I sincerely apologize. Today's case is a very, very interesting one out of Lincoln, Massachusetts. And this one is one that is so mysterious. It really kind of makes you wonder what happened. And so this week we're talking about the disappearance of Joan Risch, or Risch, who went missing on October 24th, 1961 from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Joan was just 30 years old, married with two young children. She had a daughter who was four and a son who was two. Joan was born in Brooklyn in 1931, and she was raised by an aunt and an uncle after her parents died in a fire that was reported as being suspicious. So she was orphaned at a young age and raised by her aunt and uncle. And so on the morning of October 24th, 1961, her day seemed fairly routine. Martin, her husband, had left the house about 6:50 in the morning to drive to the airport for a business trip in New York. At about 9:30, Joan took her two-year-old son over to her neighbor's house across the street, and the neighbor agreed to watch the little boy named David while Joan went to a dentist appointment. And she arrived back to pick David up at about 10:55 a.m. and took the kids back home. The neighbor's four-year-old son also went over to the Risch home to play with Lillian, Joan's daughter. He later told his mom that they played outside while Joan was cutting the grass. Throughout the day, a milkman delivers their milk, and he reports that Joan is cheerful and that nothing seemed out of the ordinary. A delivery man for a cleaning company also comes to the house to collect some of Martin's suits and shirts for dry cleaning, and he too reports that Joan is cheerful, nothing seems amiss. After feeding the children lunch, Lillian and Douglas go back to Douglas's home, the Barker's home, to play while Joan put David down for a nap. According to a copy of the police report, the neighbor, Mrs. Barker, reported seeing Joan outside at about 2:30 p.m. She was wearing a red coat, and her arms were outstretched in front of her. And Mrs. Barker reported that she, quote, thought she was chasing a child, and the child was wearing a red jacket, end quote. Later, she saw Joan walking back to the home. At about 3:45, Mrs. Barker walks Lillian back across the street so she can go run some errands in Concord, Massachusetts. And Mrs. Barker returns home from shopping at about 4:15, and Lillian comes over to tell her that she can't find her mom. David is in bed upstairs sleeping, and there is what Lillian describes as red paint spilled in the kitchen. And remember, Lillian is just 4 years old. She cannot find her mom. There's this red paint in the kitchen. So Mrs. Barker goes across the street to Joan's house, and she finds that the red paint is, in fact, actually blood. The phone has been ripped from the wall, and so she knows that something is not right, and she immediately calls the police. They discover that there's other sort of ominous evidence in the home. The telephone that had been ripped from the wall was thrown into a waste basket that had been moved from the corner of the room into the center of the room. So normally it resided sort of in the corner of the room, and now it's in the middle of the floor. And you can actually see a crime scene photo of this wastebasket. And inside the trash can, there's a liquor bottle, and there's also on the counter, there's a telephone book that's open to an emergency numbers page. So this is before 911, when there were multiple numbers to get a hold of emergency services. There's a chair that's tipped over. Police find a bloody thumbprint on the phone where the phone is mounted. This is in the days of phones mounted to the wall. And so the part that's still on the wall, there's a fingerprint, a bloody fingerprint. They find fingerprints and a partial palm print on the wall and determine that these are not Jones. And it also appears that someone tried to clean up the blood. And you can actually see these crime scene photos online, and their paper towels sort of smearing this blood around, not really cleaning it up effectively. And the chair is tipped over. The waste can is mysterious. You see the phone. Thankfully, Jones' son, David, he's still upstairs asleep and unharmed. However, according to one report, police did find blood evidence in the son's room, like a drop of blood. The blood led from the son's room upstairs to the kitchen, out to the driveway where it stopped at the car. Drops of blood were found outside on the trunk of the car as well. And so police immediately begin their investigation. And neighbors reported seeing a two-toned blue car in the neighborhood that they couldn't identify who it belonged to. And it's described as a late model, late 1950s model sedan. And one neighbor said that she saw a man get out of the car near the Reish home, and he cut some long branches from the woods and placed them in the car. Which, I mean, it's an odd thing to do, but, I mean, anytime I stop alongside the road and, like, take a picture of something or, you know, do anything, I'm thinking, you know, how would this look if something were to happen? So, you know, he could have been doing something completely innocent, but he cuts these branches from the woods and puts them in the car. There are also multiple sightings of a woman matching Jones' description that are also fairly ominous. At about 2:45 p.m., one witness described seeing a woman matching Jones' description walking with the flow of traffic along Route 2A toward Concord. And the witness said that the woman appeared to be walking in an aimless fashion, and she was hunched over as if she was cold. Between 3:15 and 3:30, another witness reported seeing a woman matching Jones' description walking along Route 128. This witness reported that the woman appeared dazed and her head was down, and the witnesses described her walking in sort of a quote-unquote plodding manner and cradling her abdomen. The witness also says that there was what appeared to be blood running down her legs. Unfortunately, this witness doesn't, you know, offer any assistance, doesn't ask any questions, which I think is a little strange, you know, if you were to see someone walking along the street cradling their abdomen with blood running down their legs. I think at the least you would notify someone that, you know, she might be in distress. At about 4:25, another witness reports seeing a woman matching Jones' description walking along 128, and what they described is brownish mud on her legs. The witness also describes the woman walking with her head down, her hands in her pockets. So two witnesses have described what appears to be blood running down her legs. All three witnesses describe her as sort of hunched over, cradling her abdomen, walking in sort of an unusual manner. And because of all of these similar statements from the witnesses, police are fairly confident that the woman is in fact Joan. But they don't know why she's walking. They don't know where she's going. They don't know why she's bleeding. Police call Joan's husband back from New York. Because he wasn't there at the time of this disappearance, you know, he's in New York. He's quickly cleared. He was in New York for some business meetings. So he's not even in town. So they know that Martin is not a suspect in this. He explains that the liquor bottle was in the waste basket because he put it there the night before. He and Joan had a couple of drinks the night before, finished a bottle of liquor and put it in the waste basket. However, there are other bottles in the home, other liquor bottles on the counter, I believe, that he can't explain. He doesn't know where they're from. And investigators learn that Joan had checked out over 25 books from her local library in the summer leading up to her disappearance. And all of these books are related to murder or unexplained disappearances. And this has led to some people speculating that she staged her own disappearance. And this is of particular interest to me. I am a librarian, and I don't know what the rules were in 1961, but you can't just find out someone's checkout history from their library today. Even police have to subpoena those records, and they're not even housed at the library. There's a whole process to go through when law enforcement does subpoena someone's library checkout records. And this rule is there just to protect you, the library user, because you have a right to read whatever material you want. I also have some opinions because if people looked at my checkout history, you would probably conclude the same things about me because I love true crime, you know? So I'm checking out true crime books. Does that mean I'm staging my disappearance or staging, you know, some crime? No. What you read, I don't think is a fair indication of what your plans may be. You know, you could be researching a topic, but that doesn't mean that's your plan for yourself. You could just be, you know, working on something. So I don't think that library checkouts are a fair indication of your plans, anyhow. And so using this library checkout history as evidence, people speculated that Joan staged her disappearance using the information she learned in these books. They said that she had a successful career in publishing before becoming a housewife and a stay-at-home mom. And so they thought the speculation was that she's unhappy as a housewife and mother, and she wants to go back to publishing. However, there's no evidence of this being the case. By all accounts, Joan was devoted to her children and her husband. She was, you know, she seemed perfectly happy. She seemed perfectly happy in that. And she never once confided in anyone that she felt unfulfilled in her life. And her husband, he said that she was just an avid reader who liked suspense sort of books. And that describes a large number of people using libraries. Another theory is that she was attacked in her home. And there is the blood evidence does support that. You know, if she were to stage her own disappearance, it seems, you know, she would have had to injure herself and make it, you know, stage the entire scene. So if the theory is that she's attacked in her home, the blood evidence does sort of support that, but who attacked her? That's the question. Her husband did say that she had a habit of not being able to say no to salesmen. And if a door-to-door salesman would come, Joan just couldn't say no. And she would entertain their pitch. And could it have been a salesman who seized on the opportunity to attack Joan? This theory speculates that she was attacked and had amnesia as a result and wandered away from home and couldn't remember who she was or where she lived. Another theory is that Joan had a botched abortion. But there's no evidence to indicate that a third child would have put a strain on her relationship with her husband. By all accounts, she was a great mom and wife and very content. the theory puts forth that Joan had an abortion doctor come to the home to perform the procedure. He gave Joan some alcohol to help her relax, and which explains the liquor bottles. It also explains, you know, could explain the blood evidence. But I find this theory very unlikely. She had a very short window to invite this doctor to her home to perform a procedure when her children could come in at any point. She also had many deliveries during the day, so it seems unlikely that she would also schedule an abortion when she had all these other people showing up at her home. It is possible that she was having a miscarriage, but this doesn't explain the bloody fingerprints and palm print that don't match Joan's. And it also doesn't explain why she wouldn't call a neighbor for help, either to drive her to the hospital or to watch the children while she drove herself. It seemed like she and Mrs. Barker had, you know, a child watching agreement where they could watch each other's children. So the miscarriage doesn't 100% line up for me. The abortion doesn't 100% line up. Another theory is that Joan injured herself either intentionally or accidentally, and there's no evidence to support that Joan was suicidal. This is a popular theory, but it's not really supported by the evidence. Joan had no history of suicidal thoughts, and if she did injure herself intentionally, where was she walking? Where did she go? If the injury was accidental, why wouldn't she seek help from a neighbor? And where did she go after she injured herself? And that also doesn't explain the unidentified fingerprints and palm prints found at the house. There was construction happening along Route 28, and so people theorized that because of the blood loss, Joan became disoriented, fell into the construction pit, and was inadvertently buried. But again, why was she bleeding? Why was she walking? And so at this point, unfortunately, it's unlikely that we'll ever know what happened to Joan. Unfortunately, so much time has passed and there has been no new evidence and nobody has ever been found. The unidentified vehicle seen in the area didn't lead anywhere. Hospitals in the area didn't report admitting any woman matching Joan's description, even if Joan couldn't remember who she was. Anyone with information on this case is urged to contact the Lincoln Police Department at 781-259-8111. And so that's our episode for today. Thank you for listening and tuning in and being extremely patient with me. And so thank you so much. That's the episode. Bye.